Hey, this is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction show. Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Joel Elston here. It is Thursday, January the 19th, 2017. We continue this week with our exploration of Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, and we're up to Chapter 7. This is our sixth episode, but we're on Chapter 7, which is on the topic of organized planning, subtitled The Crystallization of Desire into Action, the Sixth Step Toward Riches. And Joel, you and I, before the show, were recognizing that well, we probably need this chapter because our organization and planning skills preparing for this episode were not as good as they could have been.
Well, Walt, that's an interesting topic to tie me this week because I had just mentioned to a colleague how I have no explanation of why, but since the beginning of the year, I have been unusually unorganized. Now, I am naturally an unorganized ADHD kind of personality type, but I work very hard to I keep multiple calendars. I get things ahead of time. I study things ahead of time. I usually read the chapter we're going to be going over with before we talk on these or prepare for our show in some form or fashion. Well, this week, I did none of that. And I've noticed that pattern for me. And the advantage of us doing the show is it can help me in areas when I find myself lacking. And this is a very important tool to sort of bring all of this together. The reason it appears in the order that it does, I believe, is now you need to get organized. Now that we understand some thought processes, I now need to implement, take action, implement, and get things heading in the right direction.
And you're absolutely right, because not only is that how we do it here on the show this week, it's actually how Napoleon Hill recommends that you do it, because the very first step he suggests is ally yourself with a group of as many people as you may need for the creation and carrying out of your plan or plans for the accumulation of money. Well, that's what we do. We get together here, not so much for accumulating money, but every week you and I get together to talk about these various issues and get ourselves back on track, and also at the same time, hopefully, help our audience get back on track. So there it is, the very first step. Create basically a mastermind group, and that's really what the chapter is all about.
Well, and one of the things our audience sort of I like to point out to the people that aren't new, that are sort of new to this, the concept of a mastermind group is when two or more people get together and discuss concepts and ideas. And in a sense, we're providing a front row seat to our listening audience, sort of a mini mastermind group. And every week we talk. Every week we discuss concepts and ideas of the law of attraction. That is a mastermind group, and you can really adjust it to whatever you want to adjust it to. But in this case, we are using it mainly as a study in an in-depth study into the law of attraction. But it really is a effective way to get out of ourselves. Everybody has a different way of thinking, and one of my great discoveries in life is I am not the smartest person on the planet. And I mean that in a very positive way. I'm not the dumbest person on the planet either. But I very much have really come to the – I love other people's opinions. I love to hear other views, whether it's political, whether it's religious, whether it's business. Or I love to be challenged and hear other opposing views of mine. And there's a time I hated that. I used to dismiss other people. But now it's an incredible tool for me. So the concept of you know, sort of allowing others into my orbit and discussing ideas or having a mastermind group, have a mastermind meeting, is an incredible tool that I used to sort of dismiss.
Oh, yeah. I agree completely. And in fact, one of the things you and I have talked about a number of times is just how personally we get jazzed by having these conversations. That's one of the biggest benefits of a mastermind group. When you bring different people in and they're sharing energy, they're basically all contributing in hopefully a positive way. If you contribute in a negative way, you'll destroy the mastermind really quickly. But if you're contributing and everybody's contributing in a positive way, everybody benefits from a huge influx of energy, and it just picks everyone up. So, I mean, it's ideal, like you said, for studying the law of attraction. But it's also ideal for, you know, you want to establish a business to earn more money. Well, a mastermind's perfect for that. I think that's why it is that most successful businesses are partnerships. There are people who succeed in establishing businesses based on just doing it themselves, but overwhelmingly the successful ones are partnerships, and that's where the mastermind really works for them.
Well, and I have had multiple experiences in my life and it, where I realized the way my brain works, and I am sort of the let's dive into the pool and about halfway there, let's hope there's water there. I'm that guy.
Yeah, that's always a good idea, isn't it?
yeah. But I like to, whereas I have always allied well, I've always had good business relationships, or, you know, I like a detail person in my life. And when I've been very successful in business or running treatment centers or whatever I've been doing, I always like to have the person, I call it the implementation person. The person, I have the ideas, I can motivate people, I can get people excited, but when it comes to the actual detail of it, I like to have somebody else there to sort of implement that, because I'm not an attention to detail kind of guy. So that's one of the beauties of the mastermind thinking process, is getting people with different perspectives. My dad, who had several successful businesses, multiple insurance agencies, and you know, one of my heroes in life, was the guy that before you open your door, you made sure you had enough paper clips. I mean, it was that level of everything down to the paper clips and the staples. And I was like, let's open these doors, and when we need paper clips, we'll run down and get them. But it was a different approach, and while his approach probably wasted a month or two of revenue waiting to open, my approach also was setting yourself up for not having a successful launch because you're not prepared enough. But when we met in the middle, it was the perfect combination of our two styles.
And that's where the mastermind is really powerful. That's the mastermind right there.
It is.
Because when you have two separate styles, or more than two separate styles, two separate ways of thinking, the energy, the thought process, the way that, you know, the two or more people fill in the gaps for each other, that's what makes stuff move along really quickly. If you're having to fill all the gaps yourself, that's a lot of work. And I can tell you that from experience, because I've been there and I've done that. It is a ton of work. I mean, it's plenty of work when you have a partner, but it's like 20 times more difficult when you're doing it yourself. And in fact, Hill makes the point that this step of forming masterminds is so critical. He says that compliance with this instruction is absolutely essential. Do not neglect it. Well, when he writes notes like that in the book, it means don't skip this one. This one's critical. You got to do this.
And what I have noticed with everybody that I've ever known on any level of intimacy whatsoever, where I really get to know people, and I'm always amazed at what it is, but there's certain things that people have an aversion to, and they have a really hard time coming over it, getting over it.
Yeah.
And when you get to a part of this book, or anything in life, but especially when you have a detailed step-by-step action like we're talking about right now, when you hit a step that you cringe at, or you're like, oh, I don't want to do that, that more than likely is the step you need to work the hardest on.
Right.
I really believe that, because if you keep failing, if you have been in a situation in the past where you've keep failing, and then you find something that you feel uncomfortable doing, that almost always is the tool that you most need to get past the redundant behavior.
And it's
leading to failure.
It's maddening, too, because we know that's true on a certain deep level. We know it's true, and yet we do everything we can to avoid that one thing because it's so uncomfortable.
Right. It's one of those things that just makes you cringe. So for many people, sitting around, you know, like sitting around a group of as many people as you can muster, and, you know, and talking and openly sharing ideas, for some people, that's like, oh, I don't want to do that. And I randomly, in the past, when now that I have a foster child back at my home, I don't have the freedom that I once had to do these things, but I love there used to be a website I belonged to that would randomly say, hey, by the way, there's a mastermind meeting 2 miles from you today. And I would stop in other people's mastermind meetings. They'd advertise them. They're almost like 12-step meetings in some areas. Mm-hmm. And was, you know, and almost every time was very uplifted by the meeting, even if the general topic wasn't toward what I was after. It was great to see different minds at work discussing theories and ideas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because when you have that, that's the energy transfer. That's the juice that the people involved in the mastermind give each other just through the exchange of ideas. And that energy can carry you for days at a time, depending on how high the energy level was.
Well, and the idea of making, especially when it comes to people and money and ideas of how to make money, I have a theory that you pretty much can make as much money as on it if you really believe the concept will work. I know people that make a lot of money in multi-level marketing. I cringe at multi-level marketing.
You
if I
and
want
me
to talk
both.
About it,
oh god!
It is the most uncomfortable setting when you have your friends. I have a very dear friend, and I got very frustrated with him one time when he right after I left my previous employer and was in business for myself, so I had a lot going on, and he is a professional, and he said, "Hey, I really need to meet with you and talk about what's happening in your future." And I thought this might even be an opportunity for him and I to collaborate. You know, I didn't know exactly what it was looking at. Mm. So I was excited about the meeting. So I canceled a couple of things and made it a priority to meet with him the next day. When they get there, he brings me this guy that was selling this mushroom coffee on a multi-level marketing deal.
Mushroom coffee, huh? Okay.
Yes, and was telling me the brain benefits of this mushroom coffee. And I looked at him, and the guy had his computer presentation, and he says, you know, you'll be making $4,000 a week in a month if you do this. And of all people to bring that to, of me who have studied the brain and nutritional supplements and all the different theories, I'm like, I looked at my friend like, really? You did this? So I'm not saying that no one has ever made a lot of money selling this, you know, coffee for the brain health, but I also know that I am so averse to that that I have very little shot of making a multi-level marketing product work, because I don't. That's just one of the things that I don't believe in. I think it's scammy most of the time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, he ignored the mastermind part, didn't he? Because
he didn't
bring you in before he launched the thing. He brought you in after. Well, that's not a mastermind. That's a sales pitch.
It's a sales pitch, and it's sort of a lot of times. And the reason I bring that up, a lot of times people when you talk mastermind are thinking, oh, that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to bring me in a sales pitch. And I want to be clear. It's two separate things. It's not going to a multi-level marketing concept,
right.
And you know the idea that when you get together, there isn't, if you have one preconceived idea and only one preconceived idea, and you're stuck on that one preconceived idea, then that's not what a mastermind meeting is about.
Right. I mean, the whole point of a mastermind, beyond the energy thing, which is certainly very big, I mean, Hill describes it very nicely. He says no individual has sufficient experience, education, native ability, and knowledge to ensure the accumulation of a great fortune without the cooperation of other people. Every plan you adopt in your endeavor to accumulate wealth should be the joint creation of yourself and every other member of your mastermind group. You may originate your own plans, either in whole or in part, but see that those plans are checked and approved by the members of your mastermind alliance. Well, if you're trying to sell something because you've already put your thing together, you're long past the checking stage. You put the cart before the horse, and that's, to me, that's where the big problem with multi-level marketing is. Multi-level marketers try to do that education. They try to present to you how much experience there is and native ability and knowledge has already been figured out. You don't have to figure all this out. It's all been figured out for you. Yeah, but that's where the most important learning happens. They put the cart before the horse, and that's why for many of us, multi-level marketing is just so repulsive. It's
right.
Just, it's reversing the whole process.
And it doesn't. As I said, I know people that do very well in that field. But it's something for me. It's a personal aversion. And another caveat that I need to point out, or another sort of perspective of this, is I have also found I've had mastermind meetings where, for example, there were several therapists that I used to supervise, and when I left the company that I worked for, I had a mastermind meeting one time with probably six of these former therapists. And our role in the past had always been me being supervisor and they being subservient. So I found that was not an effective mastermind because nobody would challenge me.
Right.
And it's like, it was like, no. I'm not telling you my ideas and everybody kiss my butt and tell me what a great brain I have. I'm wanting you to say, no, here's what I think. Here's what you made me think about. But instead they're like, that's a great idea, Joel. Let's do that. I'm like, okay, that's not exactly what it's about. But you want different points of view. You want to challenge each other. But the key point that Hill points out also is you must maintain perfect harmony within the group. Mm-hmm. You must. It can't become, while I want to be challenged, I don't want it to be adversarial. I don't want you screaming at me and threatening to kill me, or I'm quitting this group because you don't agree with me. The point is our goal is lifting each other up together. You and I do a wonderful job of that every week, where we you and I don't always agree on every single version of everything exactly.
Well, it'd be boring if we did. Let's be honest, it would be deadly boring.
Can you imagine? I don't want to live in a world where I love the other ideas. I have some friends, especially when it comes to religion and politics, that if you don't believe exactly like they believe, they really freak out.
Oh, and I'm like,
why do you want to live in that world? It's not a fun place.
Well, they obviously haven't thought it through. If they thought it through and realized that every single day, every thought that came to them was going to be a thought they already had, they don't realize they'd be falling asleep by noon.
Right. With my private practice, my foster care child, and everything that I have going on, I started a new venture this week.
Oh, really?
Where, yes, I'm working with the Amen Clinic and Dr. Daniel Amen, who does brain scans.
Okay.
And I am now becoming certified in therapy using he has a new certification that comes along that I basically learned everything there is about brain scans and how it applies to behavior and all that. And I'm applying it to my private practice. And I believe, as I've always told you, I believe there's a direct connection to the law of attraction with all this anyway. And so I'm always about adding more to the equation. I feel like it's let's keep pursuing, let's keep challenging ourselves. And this is our exploration. Forget Mars. Let's explore the brain. What we don't know about the brain is far more than what we do know about the brain.
Is this the guy you were telling us about a week or two ago who could read a brain scan and tell you exactly what's going on, what your psychosis is or whatever else?
Yes, absolutely. And I refer clients to them often, and they called me and said, we really appreciate the clients. We started talking. I talked to Dr. Amen briefly, and he says, look, we're doing a certification thing. Would you like to take that? And absolutely. So so I've added another 5 hours of studying a week, or 5 hours a day, it seems like, on some days. So but it's very exciting concept for me, and it adds stuff to it. So I see from a brain perspective. When you look at what happens, when you're studying the brain, and when you go to church, for example, and I'll use church because hopefully most people are using church for this way. When a group of people get together and they are positive, when it's a positive message, and we sort of come together, like the point of us, we're to help others, we're to do things. When that's the message, that's an incredibly powerful tool.
Oh, yeah.
Because it gets a group of people together in a very positive manner. One of the things that I find interesting, and with as little commentary as I can add to that, is Pastor Joel Osteen, not Joel Elston, Joel Osteen, and he gets a lot of criticism because his doctrine is that of positive thinking, basically.
Right.
He's Christian in his belief, but he stresses the positive aspects of Christianity and the positive nature of Jesus's message. Well, his church grows by leaps and bounds. It is a massive church. He's very wildly popular because the message of positivity resonates. The traditional old school fire and brimstone, burn in hell, you need to quit studying knowledge and just simply accept what we tell you as fact. Those churches are dying of two or three a week.
Thank goodness.
They really. I know a church locally. I have a very good friend that's involved. He's trying to revive it with the message that you and I speak of. This was a church that once had 800 or 900 people attending weekly. Mm. The last several weeks, they've had less than 50.
Wow, that's a big drop.
It occupies this huge piece of property. It's a beautiful, majestic building, and what their response was as this has been going down over week after week after week, this attendance, and the response was they kept bringing in a more and more hardcore Southern Baptist preacher.
You know, you do that often enough, you would think that eventually they would draw the conclusion that bringing in that preacher may not have been the best of ideas.
That's exactly, you know, so the idea that the more they brought it, so now they have this guy that is hoping before it's too late could change it. But I I'm finding it interesting with as little as commentary as I said that the positive message churches are growing leaps and bounds. The ones that are talking about, you know, the salvation of the soul by helping others and help, and there's a lot of other stuff out there about being selfless, about not getting involved in other people's stuff other than thinking positively. Those are amazing messages that are resonating with people, and some people believe it's sort of a law of attraction type thing, but
because the law of attraction can be practiced on either the positive or the negative side, but those of us who like to study it realize pretty early on you don't want to be on the negative side because it becomes a negative resonance thing. It just starts to build and build and build and build so that all of a sudden all you have is negativity in your life, negative events, bad things happening, and so forth. And you realize, no, that's not the way to live. We want to live on the positive side. And the fact that not just churches – I don't think it's just churches, although it's certainly good to hear that churches are doing better when they're positive and doing worse when they're negative. But I think this is something that's kind of reflective of what's going on worldwide culturally. People are so sick of the negativity and they're so hungry for the positive that when the positive does come along, they gravitate to it. And really that is the core of what Hill was talking about with the mastermind. Because the mastermind, like you pointed out, has to be not just like-minded, but it also has to be people who are committed to contributing to it rather than tearing it down. If you contribute to it, if you make it a positive experience, all kinds of good things come out of it. If you're doing it for the purpose that Hill talked about, which is to, you know, acquire wealth, to build a business, then a positive mastermind group will help you build that business faster than you could possibly imagine having done by yourself. On the other hand, if you turn it into a negative mastermind, it'll tear down your program so quickly you'll wonder, you know, where did the darn thing go? I just thought about this thing yesterday, but it'll be gone. That's the way it works.
It's so important because he uses the example of Thomas Edison and the light bulb, his invention of the light bulb, how he failed, and he uses quotation marks around the word failed in the description, 10,000 times before he perfected the incandescent light bulb. 10,000 times he failed. And that's almost it's hard to imagine.
That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of failing. However, the connotation of the word failing, it really, we've discussed this in the past. Failing, you know, I have redefined, I've given failure an entirely new definition in my mind. Failure is by far, it is not a negative tool in my toolkit any longer. Failure is, if I really believe that if I don't fail at least once a day, I am not trying hard enough.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah, and so the idea that, I want to push the bar up to failure, and where I was able to the first time I could translate that into a positive was in my working out, my weightlifting. As you know, I do that pretty adamantly. I'm a pretty heavy weightlifter.
Right.
And to get stronger, I learned early, I lift weights until I cannot move the weight any longer. Then that's how you get stronger. The body has to adapt. So I equate failure in the gym as a very positive thing. You never get stronger. Nobody's ever gotten stronger without failure. And I now apply that in my life. Failure is a temporary condition that unless you allow it to become a permanent condition. And then that changes everything.
Oh, yeah. And Edison believed that, too. There's no way that you can put yourself through 10,000 failures if you don't believe that it's making you stronger.
Yes.
Otherwise, it would be so psychologically damaging, you wouldn't be able to do it.
Right.
The other thing about Edison, too, I read an interesting article that dovetails into this perfectly. And I'm trying to remember who the author is, and I can't remember. But it was just within the last week or maybe 2 weeks. The author posed an interesting question. If you were to think of Edison in his laboratory, and you imagine him, in this case, you know, inventing the electric light bulb, what vision do you have? If you ask that question to a large population of people, most of them will visualize him in this white lab coat, and there's like this glow around him, and he's all by himself in the factory, and there's like this white light focusing on what it is he's doing, and there's the light bulb, and it's starting to glow. That's the way they visualize Edison working. And it turns out that couldn't be farther from the truth, because Edison was a huge advocate of the mastermind. He had 30, 40, 50 people working with him, engineers working with him in his laboratory day in, day out, working on all these inventions. The idea of him being this lone creative genius is so far from reality as to be laughable. And yet, when you actually ask people who don't know the Edison story what they imagine the loner.
A misconception on so many levels of when you look at successful people. You take it, you know, every successful person, and my definition of success may differ from others, has become successful through a collaboration of events. We're in the middle of football playoffs right now, and we're recording this before the results of the divisional round game. So my assumption is the Patriots are going to win. That's what happens normally every year. And not a Patriots fan per se, but they do tend to win. So I look at Tom Brady, for example, and he's viewed as by many people as a very arrogant man, you know, self-made, this, that, the other. But for Tom Brady to become Tom Brady had – tons of help, tons of coaches, tons of receivers, tons of Tom Brady is a collaboration of his family's dedication to him as a child. He has a work ethic that's installed in him. He was drafted in the lower rounds.
He was drafted 199th. I don't know much about football, but I do know that statistic, and that's right. Mind-boggling. I mean, 198 times the NFL teams didn't notice that Tom Brady was available.
Right, and he turned out to be. That arguably, and using winning as a standard, forget the other stuff, probably he's in anybody's top five, and I know people that argue he's the best quarterback to ever play the game. And it isn't because of his skill set as much as his winning ability. I mean, he's got a great skill set, but his mind is dedicated to winning, and he developed that through a lot of work with a lot of people. So everybody that's obtained success has done so with a collaboration of other people. Now, they might not always herald that collaboration as a method to their success, but there's very few people that didn't have a group supporting them. I am successful today, in my opinion, and I'm saying that without arrogance, but I hit extreme failure, and I built myself back up, and I spent a lot of energy, but along the way, I didn't have people helping me financially, but I had people helping me emotionally. I had people supporting me emotionally and helping direct the path that I was heading. And I'm very proud of where I ended up, but I could not have done it without the help of other people.
Oh, yeah. I don't follow NFL football at all, and I don't follow the Patriots. So I don't know that Brady has said this kind of thing, but I imagine he is. He has said this because if you're a winner, you learn to say these things because they're true. Joe Montana, I know, said this, so that's why I'm going to attribute it to Joe Montana. Back in the day when he was winning all the Super Bowls with the San Francisco 49ers, any time that the press asked him about his success and how great he was and how his passing ability had improved so much and yada, 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 he kept saying, look, guys, I can't do this without this fantastic five-man offensive line that protects me every week. If it weren't for them, I wouldn't have any of these records. You're pointing at the wrong person. It's the offensive line that made my records possible. And he recognized the importance. That's not just a mastermind. That's a master action plan.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to spend a little time with Emmitt Smith, the great running back for the Dallas Cowboys.
Former
Florida Gator. Great man. I really enjoy his company. And his sincere, and I'm talking in private, not talking about what he says publicly, which is the same thing. He said, I had the best offensive line in the history of football.
Mm.
He said, anybody back there would be breaking these records. And that was such a humble thing to say for the leading all-time rusher is, that's great. Now I happen to think he has quite a bit of skill himself.
Oh, yeah. But
the concept that he truly, truly will correct anyone, even in private, saying, no, I was behind the best offensive line. You could take any person coming out of college that is a decent running back and put them behind that offensive line, and they're going to lead the league in rushing, period. And he believed that. And
it's true. Think about it. I mean, I don't care how much athletic ability you've got. If you've got three 350-pound linebackers surrounding you, you don't have a prayer.
Right. Well, and on the other hand, when you look at just the amazing stuff that he has done in his life and became the leading all-time rusher, but yet he still insists on – it would be easy to become arrogant and say, yes, I did that. But he – even to this day, he says, well, I appreciate the compliment. However, I need to remind you, I was behind the best offensive line in the history of the NFL. And he believes that deep in his core. When you believe that you've been given – an opportunity of support and mastermind is an opportunity for support. When you take that, yes, how could I fail when I have some of the best minds I've ever met working on my behalf?
Yeah.
You pick up that energy, you become successful. There's an old statement, and I forget where it comes, and I'm going to butcher it, but somebody can look it up. You tend to hang out with people in your peer group, that make the same amount of money. Like if you have 10 people and your 10 best friends, you more than likely make somewhere in the range of where your friends make. Millionaires hang out with millionaires. Poor people hang out with poor people. Who are you hanging out with? Who's the group that's around you? I've always told people one great way to success, if you find a bunch of wealthy people and figure out a way to hang out with them.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely ideal. But even if you can't find a bunch of wealthy people to hang out with, it's almost as good to hang out with a bunch of people who are poor or at the same economic level as you are, as long as they have a positive attitude. Because if you have the positive attitude, it's just like you were hanging out with the wealthy ones. The only difference is what's in their pocket.
Well, and the piece of the law of attraction that when I say wealthy people, people that are wealthy, whether they have actually obtained the money yet or not, wealth is a state of mind. Poor is a state of mind. And I've always believed, I know that for my life. I understood that being poor, I've watched people that are poor remain poor because they believe they're poor. I've seen wealthy people lose everything and get it back because they believe they're wealthy. They never believe they were poor. And so when I say hanging out with wealthy people, I'm reframing what you're saying. Wealthy people in the sense of people who believe they're in wealth.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, the amount of money, successful people, the amount of it's about the mind versus the actuality of it all. I don't look at if a group of people are talking about success and they're believing success, they're wealthy, and then it becomes fulfilled. That's the whole point of the law of attraction.
And by the way, you actually do engage in masterminds and your work, don't you? Because you're a therapist.
Absolutely.
But you're not just a therapist. You're a therapist who applies the law of attraction. So you're actually trying to train and teach your clients to use the principles of positive thinking toward their own health and recovery. And that has to be a mastermind experience all by itself.
Right. It is. It becomes... Now, obviously, when the client comes in, they're not realizing that. But as we collaborate with this and we see it go forward, I'm watching mindsets change.
Oh, you know,
I'm watching as I say every you see me post this on Facebook. I have the privilege of seeing miracles happen every week. Mm-hmm. I really do. I see people's life change for the positive every week. Stuff that they didn't believe they could ever do. See people become successful in areas they never thought they'd be successful at. So I get reinforced with that. I pull them up, then they pull me up, so to speak. It works together.
Yeah.
And you know, and one of the things a little further down the chapter that I don't want to get too far along here without addressing this. Hill also refers to the major attributes of leadership. And the first one he mentions is unwavering courage. That's incredible to me. And when I see people, courage is a word that I guess you have a definition of what that means to you. But courage is getting up every day, blindly doing what you know you need to be doing, even though when you don't feel like you need to be doing. Courage to me is when you have that single mom that gets up every day and is forcing her way through life. That's courage to me. Courage isn't necessarily somebody that, you know, runs into a blaze of gunfire. That is, it can be courage as well. But on a daily level, getting up and doing what you need to be doing without worrying about, okay, poor me, woe is me. No fault, you know, don't be dominant in your leadership. Have courage in your leadership. And that's a big thing for me in that. I don't know if that relates with you at all, Walt.
It does. And in fact, I'll relate it directly to the law of attraction. Because for me, the most courageous thing that any of us can do is to choose positivity in the face of overwhelming negativity. It sounds
Absolutely.
On the surface like something that, well, yeah, you should be doing that. But how many of us can actually honestly say that we pursue in a courageous way every single day, a determination every time we find ourselves going into a negative thought pattern to pull ourselves out of it and put ourselves onto a positive thought pattern, despite the fact that we keep messing it up? How many of us are willing to actually have the courage to say, by God, today I'm going to do it. By God, today I'm going to do it. And just keep after it and after it and after it. There aren't many. Not many people are that courageous. They could be. They should
and,
be.
And
it's definitely a lot easier once you start doing it. But that initial inertia is seemingly overwhelming.
Right. And that's that piece for me, that courage piece of reminding, that is the definition of courage. It's one of the words that I have sort of things around my house, like posters with words on them. I've made these. I didn't buy them, but and one of the my big one is when I walk out of my room every morning, the courage is the one I see first.
Mm.
And courage is it, I got it from this, but courage, unwavering courage, just getting up and doing it in spite of yourself, in spite of where you've been, you know, it because knowing that I'm doing it, I believe I've used this before. Everybody that wakes up every morning does so out of hope of things being better. I don't, whether they realize it or not, we get up every day out of hope. We might not always live in hope, but the idea that when you go to bed, you get up, say, maybe this is the day it changes.
That's
and,
right.
You know, and one of the, and the second major attribute of leadership is self-control.
Which is why we engage in courage in the first place. We're trying to learn the self-control.
That's why it goes right into it. And for many people, self-control is very difficult. The man who cannot control himself can never control others. Self-control sets a mighty example for one's followers, which the more intelligent will emulate. Meaning, you lead people by you being in control of yourself. You're not going to, you know. I had a former employer, was exceptionally wealthy. I mean, probably billionaire status. His family. And because of his wealth, he always led by intimidation. If you don't do this, I will fire you and take your money away. I will harm your reputation. I will make you know, he could be brutal in dealing with people.
He was really afraid, wasn't he? I mean, he was terrified.
Very afraid. Absolutely. And the problem was, while his vision was positive, which I always admired his vision, his way of implementing it was negative. That's why his results were tended to be negative. He had an incredibly high turnover rate. Nobody would stay with him. In some of the higher end positions, he could never maintain professionals because they wouldn't work with him. And so he ended up with a depleted workforce of probably, you know, not to be derogatory, but people of that could accept working in those conditions who aren't always the healthiest people. So the idea of self-control, not going off, not going crazy, not screaming and yelling and being negative and hateful, controlling yourself, keeping positive. The main reason of that is that's the only way you can develop leadership. And the major attributes of leadership, self-control it's listed number two for a reason. Number three is a keen sense of justice.
And before you get to sense of justice, I just wanted to add one more thought. Your friend is a perfect example of what we're talking about in the sense that he knew it was important to be positive, and yet he struggled to apply what he knew about positivity to his dealings with others. And so he kept repeating the same mistake over and over and over again, and he kept experiencing the bad results. That's where the courage is so important. He needs at some point, and he will eventually, I'm sure he will eventually, as long as he sticks to the positive platform, if you will, he will eventually get there. But he needs to develop the courage to treat other people better. He needs to develop the courage to overcome his fear that if he doesn't treat people badly, they won't perform for him.
Well, and one of this is an example sometimes of where extreme wealth can be a detriment, because whether he gets that or not, and your confidence in him is more than mine, whether he gets that or not, he's allowed, no matter what he does, he could never run out of money. That's an incredible place to be in.
Yeah.
Most of us say, okay, if I don't learn to be a good leader and don't become I'm not going to be able to make a living. I'm not going to be able to do this or work within an environment or learn to follow somebody who's leading correctly. I mean, you don't have to always be the leader, but the idea that he would never have to work a day in his life, no matter what happens, if he lost $50 million, he still has another $950 million to fall back on.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that, whatever. So the driving factor that normally keeps most people in that direction is sort of lost on him. And he does have a good idea about a lot of things, but he's never been successful. He's had multiple businesses that have all failed. They've all lost millions of dollars, and he just keeps coming back to the well and not understanding it isn't the business idea that's the problem. It's his attitude, the way he leads, it's the problem.
And it's quite possible. He actually could, depending on how his family has structured their wealth, it's conceivable he actually could lose the whole thing. I mean, if he's lost it in small amounts, that doesn't prevent him from losing it in big amounts. It actually encourages it. So it's possible he could drive his family into the ground. It certainly happened before. I mean, I recall an incident from the 70s. The Hunt family tried to corner the silver market and basically bankrupted themselves in the process. They were billionaires.
Absolutely.
Billionaires in the 70s when billionaires really meant something.
Absolutely.
And yet they managed to do it, you know. So it's quite possible. I hope he doesn't do that. I hope he actually learns the lesson before then. But maybe that's what it'll take. Who knows?
It may be, and fortunately his family is also – they have safeguards in place that he – So he can lose some money, but he can't lose nothing.
So he's protected against his own worst intentions and plans and so forth. He's protected against, yeah. Which I guess is good,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, it is good. But he's also someone who isn't very happy. He's you can see he's always looking for happiness, but he's never going to get it because of this one factor. And when I say negative, I hope he does. He's I still like the guy. I admire his vision. I admire it. I just think the idea that, wow, if we could just get him to the other side, what an incredible journey he'd be on. And
well, I think that's why it really comes down to whether or not he stays positive, because that's a person who could very easily fall off the positivity bandwagon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And so the next is a keen sense of justice. If without a sense of fairness and justice, no leader can command or retain the respect of his followers. I mean, it's literally, keen sense of justice, being fair, treating others with fairness. I know one thing I always admire, and for many reasons I admire about my dad, but my dad was someone who his word and his handshake was his bond. Mm. And a lot of people say that, but he had years ago, he had a piece of property, and I witnessed all this. And in the big scheme of life, it's not that big of a deal, but there's a gentleman that owned the piece of property next to his, and he was a farmer and he wanted to, it was near interstate. And he called my dad and he said, would you sell me that piece of property? My dad said, well, okay. And he said, let's just get an acre of land's going for, at the time, probably $5,000, and there's 3 acres. So I'll take $15,000 for the property. That's very fair. Well, the guy said, great, we'll get the attorneys together. Well, things happen in a month or two, nothing comes up. Well, that was a phone call that happened. Well, in the meantime, a gentleman stops in that for a major fast food company and said, we're interested in buying your land. And my dad said, well, I have a contract on that land already. They says, well, we're sure you will not, or whatever the term was, you'll go with us if you don't have an official contract, because we're offering you $75,000 for the land.
Uh-huh.
And my dad said, without blinking, I'm sorry, I've made a verbal commitment to this gentleman, and we will follow through with it. And he did.
There aren't many people who will do that these days.
No. And so, I witnessed that. I witnessed him, and that's one example. There are many smaller ones, but that was the biggest one I can remember.
Sure.
And he was a man. He is a man of his word. He didn't process things like, well, what is in my best interest? His best interest was keeping his word, and he knew that. And that was an amazing thing, and that's why my dad remains one of my heroes, because he has a keen sense of justice, and I strive to have that same keen sense of justice, and I try to implement that in my life as well.
Something also for us to remember about a keen sense of justice. Justice is not the same thing as retribution. It's not the same thing as revenge. And so
Absolutely.
Often people think of justice. If there were any justice in the world, that wealthy bugger over there would give up some of his money so the rest of us can have it. That's not justice.
No.
It's not even close to justice.
No, it doesn't fit the bar at all. I mean, justice is you doing the right thing, not judging others for not doing the right thing. There's a legal definition of the justice system. That is not what Mr. Hill is speaking about here.
No, what he's talking about is even-handedness and fair play and even the word fair. Have you ever looked at the word fair, Joel? I actually looked it up one time to really understand what fair meant. Fair actually comes from pleasant. That's where it derives from. Fair is pleasant. So fairness is pleasantness. Fairness is positivity. So really, a sense of justice is a sense of positivity. It's a positive appreciation of the way things should be.
And that's a great – I didn't know that. I never looked it up. I'm glad you said that. That's excellent.
Yeah, it surprised me because I expected fair to be something like even-handed or something like that. That's not what the root is.
Wow, that's amazing. The next is a definiteness, I can say that hopefully, of decision. the man who wavers in his decisions shows that he is not sure of himself. He cannot lead others successfully. Mm-hmm. When you have someone, one of the things before this previous election, the last election we had, one of the things that was often a big factor was someone who wavered in their decision was a big factor in people who they vote for.
Right.
It seemed like it came up sort of the opposite this time. The more you wavered, the more you get more votes you got. But it's the idea that leadership is definite. When you don't waver in your decision. Now, there's a big difference, and here's a key point. As long as that decision was arrived at using the proper means, don't waver in your decisions. You can be bullheaded and unwilling to see where your decisions are wrong. There's a big that's where a lot of people get tripped up, and I think that's why it's number four in definite decision. If you have unwavering courage, self-control, a keen sense of justice, then, and you've done your mastermind planning, then the definite decision makes sense. If you pick a path at that point in order, follow it, and you stick with it.
Yes. And in fact, that's why the mastermind is so intensely valuable. Because when you have a mastermind group, if you try to take on a definite decision of a kind that is contrary to what's going on in the group, it's going to undermine you. And if you try to waver within your mastermind, the mastermind people, the people in your mastermind group are going to say, well, you're wavering in your decision here. This is not a good thing. If you're going to stick to something, stick to something. If you're not going to stick to something, you know, get off the pot, as the old saying used to be. That's what the mastermind does. It holds you accountable to your own decision-making process.
Yes. And that is so important. And really part B of that is the next one. It's the definiteness of plans, meaning the successful leader must plan his work and work his plan. A leader who moves by guesswork without practical definite plans is comparable to a ship without a rudder. Sooner or later, it will land on the rocks. Mm-hmm. And again, if you just tuned in, we're not discussing the current political climate. We're talking about definiteness of plans, where in your Mastermind Building Product program, you've developed a plan, you have definiteness of decisions, but now we got a plan. We've planned this out. It makes no sense to make a plan and then not follow through with it. That's what happens to many people.
Again, another advantage to working with a mastermind. If you're in a mastermind group, they're going to hold your feet to the fire. This is what we agreed to do. So let's go do it. Come on, let's get off the pot. Let's go do it.
Well, absolutely.
Definiteness of plans requires that you stick to your plan. And mastermind groups are wonderful for that. In fact, isn't that
absolutely
the essence of a 12-step, Joel? I mean, you're more of an expert of 12 steps than I am.
It should be. A 12-step group should be that. That should be the point. Unfortunately, for many 12-step groups, they go the other direction. But should be. You know, you're right. That's the point of a 12-step group, a group of people in a positive direction moving forward in their recovery. It's an amazing tool when done properly.
Yeah, I can see how it would be.
It is. And the next is the habit of doing more than you're paid for. This turns a lot of people the wrong way. One of my goals in coaching people and discussing people is I always want to deliver more than I have to deliver. I allow for, you know, most therapists do 50-minute sessions. Some I know do 45-minute sessions. I allow most of my sessions go between an hour and 10 minutes. I allow hour 30-minute blocks for each person. I have to do my notes in between. And the reason I do that is, first of all, I want to deliver more than others. I think that's very important. I don't log every single phone call or every single email. A lot of people do that. A lot of people say, Joel, you leave a lot of money on the table by talking to somebody's parents for 15 minutes without logging that in and charging them for it. And I appreciate that. Yeah, from a pure business standpoint, you're probably right. But from a delivering more than when that person refers somebody, they have without a doubt that I'm in this because I'm in it for a passion. I'm not keeping up with every single minute of my time. You know, I had an attorney do some work for me, and he charged me $10 per email.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, to read my an email. And crazy. Some of my emails were real, you know, here's the information you requested. And I sent a ka-ching, $10. I'm like, wow. I learned that pretty quick. Every phone call, whether it was a minute or not, was 15 minutes of his time. So I learned to take the full 15 minutes if I was going to talk to him. So it's just, you know, that worked for him. It doesn't work for me. You develop the habit of delivering more. Then when people look at you, one great example that I tried to set, and when I was at another previous employer, I'm not recommending this, by the way. I'm just saying what I did. On a Friday morning, my gallbladder was giving me problems, and I left work at noon to go have my gallbladder taken out. Monday, the doctor said take a couple weeks off work. Monday morning, I showed up at work. Now, I didn't have to do manual labor. I didn't have to do any of that, but I showed up at work Monday morning. Number one, everybody's like, oh, my God, what are you doing here? You said gallbladder surgery. I said, I'm fine. Worked the entire day. Did fine. But going forward, when that person said, you know, boy, I got a little head cold today. Do I need to go into work? Yeah. Yeah, you do. Joel went in with his gallbladder. You set a goal. You set a standard. You set a standard, and other people can use that as a goal in the future. Really important.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the number seven, pleasing personality, being upbeat, positive, is redundant to even what we're always talking about. It is the key. Mm-hmm. Pleasing personality. We don't want to be annoying and obnoxious and a negativity factor in people's lives.
So is number eight, sympathy and understanding. I mean, how can you possibly have a pleasing personality without also being sympathetic and understanding?
Loyalty. One of the things I used to do when I have moms or dads, their kids, you know, if your kid had a play, go to that play. I'm not docking you for pay. Go. You need to go to a school conference, go to a school conference. Once you do that, that endears loyalty. I know a lot of players, well, you clock out and you go do that. No, go do that. But when I need some extra, be willing to put in some extra without billing me for it either.
Right.
And it worked both ways.
Exactly.
And it worked great. You know, mastery of detail. My big deficit that I keep on working on, clearly important, mastery of detail.
Mastery of detail, and it goes along with willingness to assume full responsibility, number 10. Again, two principles that work together.
Yep, and the other one is sort of the wrap, cooperation. The successful leader must understand and apply the principle of cooperation, cooperative effort, and be able to induce his followers to do the same. Self-explanatory. Excellent point.
Excellent point.
And that's the exciting point.
And yeah, 11 points to this thing. 11 points to how to organize yourself, how to get organized and to stay organized, which is really what the chapter is all about. But staying organized is not just the paperclip thing. It's the much broader picture. It's why the mastermind is so important. And it's when you're following all these steps, you actually don't have to think about them. They come together so easily and so naturally that, you know, anyone who's actually staying organized in the way that Hill's talking about doesn't have to think about them, because you're acting true to other people. You're being kind to them. You're being sympathetic and empathetic. You're viewing them with a true sense of justice. Yeah, I mean, you're doing all the things because that's the way to treat people.
Absolutely, and that's the bottom line. And so it's such an exciting time that when you understand these, this is a step-by-step process that implementing them. It's one of the greatest tools ever given to us. This book is a great tool given to us of how to be successful.
And by the way, if you want to take the time, you can also read the 10 major causes of failure. Unfortunately, we don't really have time to go through all of those, but it is certainly worth looking at because that's what you want to avoid. However, I would spend all of your time looking on the first part because that's really the positive side of it, and you want to be focusing on positives anyway. By the way, before we run out of time, I want to remind everybody, please, if you haven't already done it, subscribe to our podcast. There are a number of ways you can do it if you haven't already. Besides listening to us here on PRN, you can follow us and subscribe to us at our website, loatoday.net. You can find us also on the iTunes store on iPhone. Actually, it's on the iTunes application. And just look for LOA Today, and you'll be able to subscribe to us there. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Google+. We're all over the place, so please subscribe. And that's about it. Joel, we're done. It's a pleasure as usual, though.
Walt, great to talk to you, my friend. Look forward to speaking with you next week.
We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.